Buddhaṃ arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
He came. You name him, he comes. All right. This is good. How's everyone? Did you have a good Saturday? Mm-hmm. A lot of things to do on Saturday?
Yeah.
So what shall we talk about? Any requests? Do you want to come right up in the front, or do you want to sit there in the back? Or lie on the massage table, or as you wish. That pile is just, you know, and disperse that pile of cushions there. That's great. I'm totally uninspired this evening, so I'm waiting for anyone to inspire me. Tell me what
you're
you want.
Never uninspired.
Aw, come on. You sweet talker. Problem is, it works with me. It works. I'm so cheap. Is there anything you want to talk about particularly? Any questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
I was looking at the picture of the Bala Chakra, the Wheel of Becoming. So I'm sort of wondering if you could talk something on that. Idea.
Yeah, it's such an interesting teaching. Whole, you know, in the mythology of Buddhism, it's very interesting to follow the steps of what happened to the Buddha. I mean, if you're really into complication, it's really fun to follow the footsteps of the Buddha before he knew he was the Buddha. And so this goes back before Shakyamuni. There was three kalpas before Shakyamuni. Now you all, of course, immediately, are you going to be comfortable? Because you could ask one of these old bods who've been sitting this way for a long time for a piece of wall. And that's a lot more comfortable. One of those old bods will move.
One of those old bods.
Probably not
that's
the guys.
An old bod.
But it's a lot easier to just lean on the wall because you won't put so much pressure.
All right.
Yeah, please, because you'll be more comfortable, and then I'll be more comfortable.
Susan.
No, it's fine.
Susan beat me to it.
Yeah, she's so fast. Yeah.
All right. I can get away with her so obviously not. Oh, there's no shame.
A slight token.
Thank you for that pillow. The old lumbar was acting up. No, it's fine. I want to see you.
Okay, so I think for me it's really has always been really interesting to trace the stories.
Okay.
You know, to understand stories because I love mythology. I love mythology. I love writing, I love poetry, I love that whole kind of storytelling quality of humanity. It just sings something to my heart and I get stoned on a good story. So for me, when I read or learn in Buddhism that the Buddha was not the first, nor will he be the last, that Buddha means the discoverer, means the one who discovers. Isn't that interesting? And what is it that is discovered? An ancient truth that gets forgotten and then is rediscovered and then it gets forgotten and then it's rediscovered. It is nothing that is ever separate. It's always present. It's always accessible. We just forget what it is. So that, you know, something rings very deep for me because that somehow feels just about exactly how I operate in a day. Where did I put my keys? You know? Do you know the feeling? Yeah. Oh! Here they are. But more than that, even. And then it says that, in fact, there have been many Buddhas, and there will be many Buddhas. And that's very helpful to me because one of my weaknesses, one of my real difficulties is believing that something can only happen once. You know, when I look at the universe, I can't believe that all of a sudden everything creaks and groans and mightily grinds into labor to produce something once out of nothing and we'll never do it again. I have a real problem with that way of thinking. Although I don't have any problem with looking out and seeing a whole bunch of things that will only happen once. I can see uniqueness in pattern, but I cannot see pattern only arising once and never again. Does that make sense to you? So for me, this whole mythology about a Buddha and what the Buddha teaches is very rich, you know, it reassures me in a funny kind of way, which may or may not be worthwhile. And there are certain things that you can tell someone is a Buddha by very specific things. One of them is the teaching that is illustrated on the wheel. The wheel is a painting. Is there one here?
The wheel?
No, yeah.
I don't believe there is.
Okay. Wheel is a painting. Hmm? Yeah, that's a different wheel. We're talking about the wheel of life. Yeah. The wheel is a painting that illustrates a teaching that is given by all Buddhas. Every time one appears, that is one of the teachings that they discover and give. That's interesting, isn't it? It is the law of how things come into be and pass away. There are 12 links to it. There is no beginning and no end. The 12 links are visualized around the edge of the wheel. The way the spokes of the wheel would be are the six realms that are continuously, the six types of lifetimes that can arise from these conditions. The very center of the wheel, high. Everybody stop and admire Jack's suntan. And congratulate him. He's walking as if he was on a seagoing vessel. See, he sways. Wonderful. How wonderful. Is your bosun,
coming.
Your mate coming?
Yeah, the bosun's coming.
The bosun. Yeah. Oh, here comes another suntan. Oh, what an excellent suntan. Welcome back.
Sort of almost back.
Oh, and a third suntan. Oh, three wonderful suntans.
Well, good thing we thought we'd get here a little early.
It is. It's wonderful. Last night it would have been more difficult, but there's lots of room tonight. So I'm talking about the wheel, the wheel of life. Have you got cushions? Do you want some cushions back there? Can you pass that back?
I'm going to grab another chair. I'm going to grab some chairs and dance.
Great. Okay. There's space right up here in front of Jack, too, if you want. So this wheel has the rim with the 12 steps of, sometimes it's called interdependence, sometimes it's called dependent origination. Then next, within that, where the spokes would be, are the six realms within which consciousness can find rebirth. At the very center of the wheel, that which drives the wheel, are the three great, they're called usually the poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion. And they're represented as a pig, a snake, and a rooster. And they each have the tail of the previous one in their mouth. So it's like unending, because if there's greed, there's also going to be hatred and delusion. And they just keep going round and round and round. And the wheel just keeps turning round and round and round. And rebirth just keeps occurring round and round and round. Okay, so that's what the wheel represents, the clear seeing of the 12 steps that continuously circle around, that continuously create the blindness, that continuously allow the circumstances to arise in which hatred and delusion can be performed, that create the seeds for further rebirth, that continuously move around and around and around and around. So it's called samsara, the realm of blind wandering. Blind wandering. Then so that is one of the things that a Buddha does when a Buddha appears. One of the things he does is he discovers the truth of dependent origination and he teaches it. There are these particular, I think there's a list of 12 things that a Buddha has to do so that you know he's the real McCoy or the real Shakyamuni or the real Deepak. One of the other things a Buddha has to have done is it has to have been prophesied by another Buddha that he will be a Buddha. So that's a neat trick. I don't think it's going to be my career choice for the next couple of kalpas, because I'm quite sure, like many of you, I recognize many of you, I'm sure that whoever you were then and whoever I was then were sitting in front of whoever that Buddha was then. We were both saying, yeah, interesting talk, yeah, interesting talk. I really don't like the way, though, you know, his robes are folded over his left shoulder, you know. I mean, it would be a lot clearer if he didn't wave his hands around so much when he talked. You know, he hasn't got that quite right yet. So here we are. Gonna perfect it, yeah. Do you think you were there? Any of you? No. Just me, huh? Okay, well, for my sins, here I am. But it's an interesting story about how the mythology about how a Buddha comes to be. Because in the history of Buddhism, which is also the history of the Hindu tradition, there are regular times where the entire of what they call the world system is dissolved and then reforms. And one time the world system will dissolve through fire, next time it'll dissolve through water, next time it'll dissolve through fire, next time it'll dissolve through water, and then it'll dissolve through fire, and then every once in a while it dissolves through wind. And whenever the world system dissolves, all of the different consciousnesses, different realms, different types of beings, have a little holiday in one of the realms that doesn't dissolve, like one of the angelic realms or something. This is interesting, isn't it? And then as everything begins to reform again, slowly the consciousnesses begin to be hypnotized by, pulled into denser realms again. And then so you have these mythologies about beings, how the earth became populated, that these kind of angelic beings were whizzing around having a good time. And the quality of the energy of the earth attracted them. They found it very delicious, and they were pulled in, and they began to eat, and then they couldn't get away. This is one of the oldest creation myths for this planet that you find in mythology. And according to Buddhist cosmology, that happens quite regularly. One creation and dissolution, the whole period is called a kalpa. It's a very long time. A kalpa is divided into sections. Every kalpa, there will be 20 Buddhas who appear. Shakyamuni is the 8th Buddha of this kalpa. This is considered a very auspicious time, contrary to doomsday prophecy. He's only number 8. 12 to go. That's interesting, isn't it? In the arising of the time of a Buddha, there is a period where that teaching is very powerful, very bright, you know, when you know the person who discovered a truth, and then when you know the person who knew the person who discovered the truth, and then you know the person who knew the person who read the book about the person who discovered the truth. So in the time of the Buddha, the teaching is very bright and it begins to get dimmer. So that's called a dispensation. So we are now at the ending time of the dispensation of the 8th Buddha of this kalpa. That's how you would keep time from a Buddhist point of view. So, you know, it's... One of the things that a Buddha does is he discovers the truth that is so simple that no one will believe it. And that's why it gets lost. Because we're looking for complication. We're trying to figure it out. And that's what he said. That's what he said when Shakyamuni Buddha said when he was enlightened, when he had achieved understanding or achieved full liberation from ignorance, greed, and hatred. He didn't see any value in trying to teach because the teaching was that he would have to give was too simple. And people wouldn't be capable of just accepting it. They keep looking for the trick. Poking it. So. Checking its trademark. But he was convinced to teach because this particular angelic being, God being, said to him, well, there could be a few people with not too much dust in their eyes who would be capable of seeing it. And the Buddha said, oh yeah, I think you're right, there could be a few. So then he went off and did some more meditation. And when he did that meditation, he formulated the Paticca-samuppada, which is the law of dependent origination, or the wheel of becoming. And it begins nowhere and ends nowhere. But where you usually, it's usually chanted at funerals. In Buddhist countries, it is one of the things that is chanted. And it begins by saying, dependent upon ignorance, upon ignoring, upon not being here, because you're trying for something that is not here, arises formations. Formations. Desires, longings. I went, I know I've told you this before, but it's the best way I know to describe sankhara, because in Pali it's avijja paccaya sankhara, dependent on formation, on dependent is paccaya, avijja is ignorance, sankhara is formations. And it's a very difficult word to translate. It is almost the same as the word archetype, if you understand really that when the word archetype was used, it, as far as I know, it meant something that was not visible. It had a force, but not a form. And the best example I can give of that is when I was in Israel and a bunch of us were pretending to swim in the Dead Sea. And the Dead Sea is thick. It is major thick. And if you get a drop splashed in your eyeball, it stingeth. Yea, verily, it hurteth much, and your eye stays red for a very long time, because the Dead Sea at one time was connected to the greater body of water, and so it was part of a whole system of oceans and seas, you know. And then as time went on and rainfall was less and there were slight shifts in the earth, it was cut off. And so it's this major body of salt water slowly bubbling away in the middle of the desert. The water is slowly evaporating and the salts are getting more and more concentrated. So it's really got a zing to it. If you get any in your mouth, you know. If you get any in your eye, you know. If you have any little cut or scratch or pimple somewhere on your body, you know. You know exactly where it is. So it's a really interesting experience. And the other thing about it is the sun is very bright there. And just the angle of the sun, it was actually piercing the surface, and you could see the sun, rays of sun, just the angle was right going below the surface. And if you just stood there, you could actually see crystals almost forming from the saturated fluid. You could see salts almost forming, then some ripple would happen, and they would just dissolve again. The propensity to be this, the propensity to be that, sankhara. Does that give you an image? That, I don't know a word other than, I think that's what, is that right, Terry? That was what archetype basically means? But it's not used that way usually in English, so I don't, I think that's the best word, but for most people that wouldn't be an understanding. So I use the Dead Sea water with bright sun. And so the sankharas are because of partial view, formations are shifting. because there are formations, some kind of senses, some kind of consciousness arises. Some kind of consciousness. Because of the consciousness arising, mind-body begins to form. A mind-body that is suitable for that consciousness to have a vehicle. Because of mind-body, there are six sense doors, six sense doors arise, appropriate to what that body desires, the senses will arise. Because the sense doors are there, contact. Now this doesn't maybe sound like much to you. This is a very profound, simple truth. Take for, and it goes on, there are 12 stages which end in birth, old age, misery, and decay. Sorrow, lamentation, and grief. And because of that, ignorance. And because of that, sankhara, and because of that consciousness, and because of that mind-body, and because of that the six sense doors, and because of that contact, feeling, grasping, clinging, birth, old age, misery, death, ignorance. Is that clear? So what you do is you take any one of them, like contact, for example. I was mentioning earlier to a friend when we were having a meal together that one of the early teachers that my beloved teacher Ananda Bodhi invited to the Dharma Center of Canada in 1967, God, I'm getting old, was a beautiful teacher named Sadatissa, who was a great, great scholar and just a profound teacher. He's dead now. And he described, it's so beautiful how he described consciousness. He said, consciousness rolls along. I can't remember exactly well, but it's all the word he used. It's almost like David Bohm's enfolding. You know how he talked about enfolding of. Were you at that time the Dharma Center? No. So it's almost like an enfolding of impressions and experiences, and they make an impression within consciousness, and then there is a tendency for that impression to repeat or to ring or to actually have a feeling of reality to it, right? And consciousness just rolls on with all these impressions, and whenever there is an opportunity for an impression to move into manifestation, it will do so. Do you get that feeling of that? Consciousness is continuously rolling on. And you have no idea what impression is about to arise, how you're going to fall in love, fall out of love, decide to go here, decide to go there, get this job, get that job, be satisfied with this, be satisfied with that. Most of it is not choice. Most of it happens to you. Most of your choices are based on your past experiences of what you like and dislike, not of what you actually know will actually come from that choice. Does that make sense to you?
Yes.
If you have watched yourself in life, you know that if you have an aversion to something, it's very hard for you to explore that aversion. Is that true? If you dislike the way someone looks, it's very hard for you to sit next to them and start to try to figure out exactly what part of it, their looks, you dislike. There's a pushing away by aversion, isn't there? The way someone talks. It's very difficult in the subtle forms of like and dislike to actually engage your intelligence and question it. You're pushed slightly this way, pushed slightly that way. By what? Half the time you don't even know. But you think you do. So basically, the wheel talks about how these very minor little moments of ignoring impressions coming up, almost forming propensities here, creating a kind of a consciousness that would prefer to go here rather than there. Do you understand?
Can you feel it, yeah.
Contact, feeling, clinging, you know? Goes here, goes there, goes here, goes there, and billions of them. And you say, no, I don't want to go out. Oh yes, I love you. I think I'll vote for the NDP. Whatever. Most of the time, you don't know why you're making the choices. So that's what the wheel talks about, how that happens. Does that answer your question?
I don't really know why. Is there some method we can apply to that?
It's called awareness.
Awareness. Yeah. Just to be aware.
Watching your reactions and not believing them. Not just believing them.
Okay.
Don't just believe because you don't like something. That means you shouldn't do it. Watch, you know, what it feels like to dislike. Is it more on the right side of your body, on the left side? Does it remind you of something? You know, really explore. Actually believe you're alive and you have the right to feel what it feels like. Don't just keep moving, but actually be interested in who's moving. That's the most powerful thing you could do. Keep doing everything you're doing, but do it with full awareness, or as full awareness as you can muster. When you're making love, actually make love. When you're swearing, actually swear. When you're going sailing, pick a tall ship. That's the only thing you really can do.
Mm-hmm. So it's like not saying to myself, who is attracted or who is repelled, but what is going on? Like, what
well,
is it?
Who is fine, too. It doesn't matter what question you use. Some people like who. Some people like, how does this work? Some people like, you know, you'll find that one way will come naturally to you, you know. Was it Ramana Maharshi, who a great teacher in India, who used "Who am I" as the mantra? That he just kept asking continuously, "Who am I? Who am I now? Who am I now? Who am I now? Who am I now? Who am I?" And that was his. That became the whole path he taught others. A very great saint and a wonderful human being. Many, many, many influences from his life. So, yeah, that's a very valuable way to do it. But you'll find a way that you actually are here, actually watching yourself and being curious. Why do you fade out here? Why don't you fade out there? I mean, who's more interesting than you anyway? You know, really. I mean, aren't you just stunningly interesting? Really.
I'm just curious about the three symbols in the center of the wheel, which is samsara, the pig, the...
It's greed, hatred, and delusion.
Why? I mean, I can understand the pig perhaps being the symbol for greed. But am I correct? Why the rooster and why the snake? Like, what does the rooster represent, symbolically?
Hatred.
Hatred. Why did you choose a rooster?
Have you ever seen roosters?
Vaguely in my childhood, but I'm not quite sure. I tried to imagine why the rooster would...
Yeah, cockfights.
What do they mean?
Why do they have to do with delusion?
The snake?
Oh, the snake is delusion.
As far as I remember, is that correct? Somebody else might know. I just assumed that. I don't remember reading it anywhere or hearing anyone teach me. That's my assumption. So I don't know, actually. I do not know.
See, I can understand the pig being greed because I've seen pigs in farms when they're hungry and they'll run over each other just to get to the trough. Just so they can, you know, that's how I imagined it because I used to watch them on the farm and going, wow. You know, they would literally run over each other just to get to the trough first, and they would push each other away to get the food. So that symbolically meant greed to me, just to, no matter what, I'm going to have it. There was that taste in it, but I couldn't understand the rooster being hatred and why the snake...
I don't know, and it would be, it would certainly be from the Eastern symbolism.
Yeah.
All over the States they have these cruel pits where people come in and both the two cocks and the two roosters. And they peck each other to death, and one wins. These cockfights are pure hatred. And you have them all over the deep south. You're going to break up most of the East generation of the story.
Okay.
I remember that image that they've seen in movies of it.
I've watched a lot of roosters, yeah, so I certainly, that's probably
what. Strong. A strong track record of pecking each other to death. If they're on each other's territory.
Which is basically what anger does, is it makes space, keeps your own space.
Mm-hmm.
Gets them intruders out of there. Doesn't it? Anger makes space, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Keeps people away.
What is that thing that holds the wheel?
That's Yamantaka. That's the great deity Yamantaka. He's very like Cronus in Greek mythology, who swallows his children. That's time. Time swallows his children. It's exactly the same mythology. We are the children of time, and we're going to be swallowed by time. Just swallow. And of course, with any good mythology, there is always the son who tricks dad and doesn't get swallowed. And that's the trick, for sure. How to wake up before time swallows you. And greed, hatred, and delusion, you know those, don't you?
A little.
Greed is when your basic sense is that if you just get one more, you'll be okay. And like Alice, when she's in the rowboat, and there's these beautiful sweet grasses, and she's, you know, Alice through the, is it through the looking glass, that one, or in Wonderland?
Isn't it the same
story?
I think, isn't it? I thought
they were the same story.
No, they're two different books.
Okay.
And
Alice
she's
in Wonderland.
Is it in Wonderland that
yeah.
she's doing that? And she's in this rowboat. You're not sure whether it's a dream or not, but she's in this rowboat. And there's these really sweet smelling rushes, and she just really just loves them. And she gathers an armful, and she just buries her. Oh, and they're so good. And she lowers them, and then she sees more. She throws these behind her, and she reaches up. Pulls more, and she just keeps pulling them and throwing them behind her, and her movement is pulling the boat along, and she has no idea where she's going. That's great. Oh, this one is going to be sick. Oh, this one is going to be sick. Oh, this one is sort of like part of the way we keep our economy going. Any minute now, I'm going to be desirable. Right? And hatred is, they're probably slimy anyway. You know, looking at the same rushes and saying, not. It doesn't look like the right idea to me. They're just going to rot. There's no point in taking them. The whole thing is useless. So greed is a sense that there isn't enough in here. Hatred is a sense that there isn't enough out there. And delusion is when you can't make up your mind. Can't fall either way. Does that make sense to you? So greed type would say, if you said, let's go to a movie, they'd say, oh yeah, well there's a triple bill at. And the hate type would say, well the only movie I want to see is at such and such and I hate the seats. And the delusion type would say, a movie, God, I haven't been to a movie since my cousin Hazel was in town. I don't know, did you ever meet Hazel? She was wonderful, my God, you know. I will always remember her with her grade 3 teacher. That was so amazing. Her grade 3 teacher, she was a Millicent, her last name was Millicent. I think that must be an English name. Is that an English name, Millicent?
Hello.
Is anybody here? It's just like... or people that when you tell them something, you see about two-thirds of the way into the telling that little shutter goes down behind their eye. And you know that as soon as your last word is out, they're going to tell you the same story, only one that they heard. That's a delusion type. Because they don't know whether they should agree with you or disagree. It's too frightening. So they just want to saran wrap. Nothing getting in, nothing getting out.
I'm going to go away and think about this later.
Does that make sense? Greed, hatred, and delusion. And we're all three. You know, you have sometimes, many times, found it very useful to have the saran wrap. Haven't you? And you also often have decided that out there should just back off because it's totally unsatisfactory anyway. And you've also always decided that it's not good enough here and you just got to get more. Haven't you? All of us have known all three of those, don't we? And they all are essentially painful because even when you get more, it doesn't actually satisfy you, but it does tire you out. Any of you ever had that experience where you get what you want, but you don't want it anymore? Or you wish everybody would go away, and then you feel so guilty because of the way, you know, the way you got them to leave, all those bits and pieces of limbs hanging around your floor. The pain of that, you know, the guilt, and then how you have to put yourself through to court them back, and then you put up with a lot of indignities because you really wish they were back again, and then you start feeling oppressed by them again, and then pretty soon you explode, and then you wish they'd all go away, and they all go away, and then you feel guilty, and then you, right? Ain't tight. And the delusion type is just like so hard to trust, so hard to feel intimacy, so hard to just be present. No special stories, bells or whistles, you know. Just here we are, welcome, hi there. So awareness comes in, and you start to be aware of that sense, if you're the greed type, of always reaching out, and try to feel what it is inside that is so hungry. Or the hate type sees that fear of being touched by the outer, and tries to see what it is out there that is so frightening. And this is the best way to counteract these. So somebody who is caught in with a lot of hatred would do the meditation on love, on being able to see beauty. That's what the meditation on love is, increasing your awareness of beauty. Because what you find beautiful, you fall in love with. Everybody die except you. And then you increase the seeing of beauty. Just increase it. You know, by a disciplined way. That's how you work with that being. The greed type, they have to become aware of the dissatisfactoriness of what they're picking. So that matches the dissatisfactoriness here. So this doesn't seem like an escape or a relief. Right? Does that make sense to you? You have to see how what you're going after is not satisfactory. You have to see less beauty on the outer so that the inner won't look so ugly. Paint a piece of shit on the carrot that you're chasing. That's a really good way to work with greed. I'm just very low key tonight, so I'm still waiting for you to inspire me to talk about. And those three just go round and round and round and round. One turns into the other, turns into the other. Where there is greed or hatred, there's delusion.
I was interested in the rebirth and how it is that we may select where we, or choose where to be reborn.
It isn't so how one can or how it has
or
happened.
If we do.
And very unlikely. What's more likely is we fit somewhere based on past habits. All of the things that you're choosing this lifetime is shaping where you're likely to keep going. I like the analogy of a hose. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Where you have the pipe, the hose, and you have the water coming full force. And when the water comes out of the hose, it still holds the form, more or less, of the laws, of the flow, the force, and the shape, and the whole thing. There's those drips that go down your pant leg or on your toe or stuff as soon as it comes out of the nozzle. But most of it kind of gathers together, and some drips fall all the way along. But there is a kind of, even when the form is no longer ruling, there are still the laws of the movement occurring. It's very similar to that. So the choices are all along. You know? Habit has more to do with rebirth than anything else.
The neighbor's trying to drive his car in the driveway, and somebody's car is, he's afraid he might hit it, so that's whoever's car is parked to the left of my driveway, maybe he'd like to have it moved out of the way. I don't know whose car it is.
To the right
of
the
car?
To the right,
facing
this way?
Yeah, from this side.
To the right.
Okay.
Yeah, where
are
you driving?
Yeah.
Yours is to the east.
Yeah.
Yours is to the west.
Yeah.
On Little Red Road?
No.
Oh.
No, I'm not on the
red road. Sorry. So you were talking about the force that drives, like the metaphor you were using to describe this, to answer her question. I was thinking to myself, I was thinking about negative habitual patterns, perhaps, that are going on in this being, perhaps, in some form or another. The way to use the word countermeasure that, if I may, would be to create more good deeds or to gain good, better merit or to sort of break away and to try. You understand what I'm saying? It's like I'm looking for the answer to break. How do we stop that rebirthing process?
There are two accumulations.
Yeah.
Two accumulations. Okay. Two things you accumulate. One of them is called merit. And the other is called wisdom.
Wisdom.
Okay. Merit basically means to be aware of the results of your actions.
Oh, that's an interesting term.
Basically means don't just live with a short-term view. Be aware of the results of your actions. Because if we're aware of the results of our actions, we stop being so dishonest, you know. We stop causing harm. We stop ripping off. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
It is more pleasant to live in an honest society. It is more pleasant not to have to lock your doors.
It wasn't my car, it was
mine.
Little white Nissan.
Musical cars. And the accumulation of wisdom basically brings one to the understanding that not only doing good is wonderful, but forgetting about yourself is downright delicious. That, you know, to move beyond self-cherishing is peaceful and joyous and feels right. Wisdom is basically no inherent self. So the accumulation of merit becomes, in full understanding, the male principle of cause and effect. Dancing in the female principle, blissful, endless, void nature.
Could you repeat that again?
So, the cause and effect, the accumulation of sila,
mm-hmm.
become, you know, it's said the two accumulations become the major and minor marks of a Buddha. That's what they say in the Tibetan tradition. Basically, that means cause and effect, being aware of the need to treat things appropriately, is like respecting all cause and effect, not just one's own personal view. Okay? That becomes the awareness, the male principle of the naming, the awareness of all movement, of coming into being and passing away, dancing, like radiant energy, dancing in the blissful, limitless field of the female state of being, the state of being, of knowing and being, of no inherent self. So the two accumulations begin with deciding you really do like living in a clean neighborhood. And it's nice to be in love. And on our very daily basis, that's where it starts. It feels better to be honest than to be dishonest. And there's something wonderful about forgetting yourself because you're happy with all beings. And it is too simple. And many people do not understand. It's very simple. It's not stupid, and it's not naive, but it sure is simple. So it starts as the practice of laws.
Thou shalt not.
I undertake to train myself to refrain from killing and harming. Not that it's possible to live without killing and harming, but it is possible to live without intending to value oneself more than others. That's the accumulation of merit. Accumulation of wisdom is being comfortable, abiding without self-reference. Was it your car? Okay. There can be self-referencing, so that's not exactly right, but without grasping at a sense of self. There is ego, there is ego structure, there is self, a sense of self, but it is not permanent. You're not the same as you were when you were 2 years old. Surprise, surprise. You probably don't even like the same foods. No kidding. You probably now don't eat like you did when you were 8, 10, 12, 14, 16. Right? If you do, you probably suffer. Right? But the feeling of being a self is there. And again, awareness, at some point you begin to explore what is self. You don't start there, usually. You start by becoming aware of like and dislike and trying to understand how they work. You do that by going and meditating and sitting there and crossing your legs and decide you're going to watch your breath. One breath, two breath, oh, this isn't so hard, I do this pretty well, I bet I could probably do this for an hour, that's already maybe I should just change my, oh yes, I'm watching my breath right now. You know, and the mind bounces all over the place, and then you find out you don't like it, and then you say, you know, you go to sleep and then you wake up, and then, but you, for some reason, there's something about it that keeps you sitting there. You don't know why. And you make bad jokes about it to all your other friends who are sitting, you know. You know, just think we're going to pay to go on a retreat. Yeah. Yeah, I can hardly wait to pay for that pain in my knees. Yeah. And you all trudge off there and you get your cushions ready, right? You start meditating. It's a silent retreat. And after 2 weeks, you're sure you've got some kind of cancer in the liver and you can't talk to anybody, you know. Isn't it true? I mean, is this all true? Have you all done this at some time or other, right? But in the process of that, you teach yourself not to fall for all the tricks, just to sit and watch. So that eventually, if you're really, really fortunate, you get strong enough so that in your daily life, you can actually sit for an hour every morning, the hardest thing in the world to do. On retreat, it's easier. You can actually go to your home and wake up every morning, do whatever you have to do, come back, sit down, and just sit there and settle the mind at one point and just allow yourself not to be pushed around by like and dislike. Allow things to just be as they are, and it changes your whole day. Right? You need to be able to do that first, and then you can start trying to figure out what the self is. You need to be able to watch other phenomena before you try to see what the phenomena of self is. Because believe you me, we hang on to that one with a real white-knuckled grip, you know? And you want to see yourself go nuts, like really stark raving, loony, cracked, trying to get rid of yourself, you know? Or try to decide that, you know, I'm going to stop ego clinging. I don't think so. Best of Irish. But to see what the self actually is, that's different. What is the self? To actually be interested. What is this that I call self? Who is the self? You know, and there are classical ways to go about it, and analyzing the self according to the physical form, analyzing the self according to feelings, it's today is the perfect world to do it in. If I had a heart transplant, am I still myself? Good question. Which self am I? Well, I do actually. After you meditate for a while, you identify that you're more than one self. Usually, don't you? You realize you have different moods, don't you? You begin to be aware that you have distinct, different phases of operation. And maybe then you start saying, which self am I? So that's not a question really for beginners so much. First you want to know, you know, what is like, what is dislike. And in order to know that, you first have to begin to see how much you're run by it. That when like and dislike enter the scene, how little choice you have. And how angry you get when you don't get what you like. Or you get what you dislike. How? Once you can actually question some of your likes and dislikes, then your mind has the strength to start questioning who is the self, what is the self. But the real test, you know, from my point of view, the real test to see whether you have the confidence, the structure, the flexibility, is in a state of active like or dislike. Can you explore that state rather than believe your story? Because when there is like or dislike, there's also a story about why, isn't there? Well, they, he, she, didn't, did, if, er, if, what, purple, pink, blue, green, and data, right? Lots of data, good hard evidence, a few witnesses, you pull in a couple of witnesses, you quote a scientific journal, right? It's all there, isn't it? But can you let go of all that and go the other way and try to explore, why am I so attached to this? Like, what would happen if I changed it a little bit here, a little bit there? And do that a little bit, then a lot of other stuff is much easier. Much easier. Certainly fear becomes much less extreme. Because you've given yourself a broader ground on which to stand, you know, you're not so rigid in what you allow to nourish you. So your sila has increased, accumulation of merit. You're not so run by like and dislike. The sila is increased, the merit has increased. In good old-fashioned English, you're not so narrow-minded. How are we doing? When we went out for dinner yesterday, and I was trying to figure out yesterday what I would talk about, and one of my dinner partners said, oh, well, maybe the fortune cookie will tell you. So we got three fortune cookies, and I picked mine up. Guess what was in it? Guess what? Nothing.
Another talk of emptiness?
Yeah, that's what I talked about yesterday, right? So today, I don't know what. Today I'm at a real loss because I talked about nothing yesterday. That was good, wasn't it? You crack it open like Shunya! The bare facts. No questions about your meditation practice, about deities, anything? I'm looking to you for inspiration.
Perhaps this question should have been asked a number of years ago. Would it also be somebody else?
It's okay.
Okay. Yep. In the Vajrayana in Tibet, why is it so important to do visualization as opposed to, like when you're doing the Vedanta practice or sadhana, there's the aspect of doing visualization. Why is that important?
And sound is also important, isn't
sound,
it?
Yeah.
In what?
In Vajrayana practice, why is there such a stress on visualization? Isn't so much, actually, it's translated as visualization, it isn't so much actually a stress on visualization as constructing with the mind's eye. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
When I say the word door, your mind's eye performs a series of possibilities of doors. It'll have a favorite.
Right.
And it's sort of vaguely there and then gone. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
And that's based on all the impressions of doors that consciousness has collected. There. Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you visualize a being. That means with the mind's eye, you bring up all your impressions. What you're doing is you're purifying all the impressions that consciousness has collected. And it's also true that, we've done this before, but we'll do it again. So, you can all see my glasses, eh? Can you see my glasses, everybody? Can you see light shining off my glasses?
Yeah.
Okay. So now rather than looking at me, just start looking at the light. Just focus on the light. Now while you're focusing on the light, pay attention to the surface of your right eyeball. Keep your equal focus on the surface of your right eyeball. And imagine that the surface of your right eyeball is actually receiving the light rather than you're looking at me. Imagine that the light that is shining off my eye, is off my glasses, is coming into your eye and washing it so that you're being washed into your head with beautiful light. A little more. See where you feel it washing in on your right surface of your right eye and where you don't. Now go to your left eye. Do the same. That the light that you're looking at is actually washing in. Now both eyes. Imagine that light goes somewhere back into your brain. There's a point back there that is receiving that light. Imagine you're sitting there. Imagine you take the elevator down your throat. And somehow some little periscope trick is happening and you're just receiving the light down. Take the elevator down one more step to the middle of your breastbone, but just in front of your spine. Just feel that. Has the quality of the light changed? Has the quality of your vision changed? Has it? Yeah. What's happened to it? Has it gotten softer, but also at the quality, like a dimmer switch change? Mm-hmm. And you do the same with sound. If you're not looking at hard objects, but you're working with energy, you begin to perceive on a more subtle level. So your body has six sense doors. Your energy body has three sense doors. They are sight, sound, and mind. So you're beginning to allow yourself, teach yourself to not only... You ever held a newborn baby? Where do they look at you?
Yeah.
They look right here, don't they?
Yeah, yes they do, yeah.
What are they looking at? Anybody ever held a newborn baby that doesn't look here? They look right there. And then slowly they learn to look at more solid energy. And then they notice, oh, it's you. Right? So, you know, they haven't learned how to perceive form in the same way yet. They're still seeing with the energy, with the mind's eye, the mind here. If you're a Buddhist, your mind is here. And so as you learn to perceive with the physical eyes, you forget how to perceive energy. But then if you remember that you're receiving energy and let yourself drop down to the heart and soften, don't go out to get it, but allow yourself to receive, you begin to refine or extend your sense of self to also be able to receive on an energy level. And that's also the level of deities. So that's why you do that, because it works, basically. I could have just said that. You do it because it works. Don?
Before I ask the question, you said the sight, sound, and...
mind. Body has six sense doors, the five senses and mind. It's speech body has three sense doors, sight, sound, and mind. Mind body has one sense door, mind only.
Now, I was just going to, when you did the Manjushri Thursday night with the aha sound and opening up the
being aware of the little blue space there.
For me, anyway, it was like the first time that refuge really started to mean something, and it's been coming back in my mind. You were talking about the river going to the ocean and then evaporating and then raining down and kind of a cycle. And that's been resonating in my mind with the poem. Was it Ezra Pound or?
Which poem?
Still Point.
Oh, T.S. T.S. Eliot, yeah.
And
four quartets.
Yeah, that
and
the symbolism of the river
the world,
and the symbolism of the still point and the symbolism of the blue center of refuge.
Yeah.
It seems like this elegant simplicity of theme that runs through everything.
Yeah.
And instinctively, for me anyway, it was like the first time I could kind of sit and listen without projecting myself on top of what I was hearing. And somehow prior to that, I felt like, well, if I'm not there, then how am I going to understand what's going on?
Exactly.
But it wasn't, it's like...
It's a non-issue.
Yeah. Don't worry about it. Your mind will just be clearer.
Well, the thing is, I'm not there and I'm still going on.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Did you hear me?
I'm not there and I'm still going on.
Yeah.
I as in, from my point of view, I.
Yeah, the I that's trying to be there. It doesn't have to be there. And nothing has to change. Everything changes and nothing changes. The only thing that changes is the dissatisfaction. Gee, that's too bad. Gee. And I just depended on it so much for that drive. For my shopping list. It was so important. Now what will I do with my credit cards? Oh, yeah. Thank you. Well, gee, I guess we'll just have to go look at the pictures of the tall ships. That's too bad. I bet you Daisy and Jack. Very tall in this area. Brought some pictures with them. I bet they did. So do you have any more? Well, wait a minute. So if you have any more questions, answers, comments, complaints. A very beautiful gold light in your hearts. And it just spreads through your body. It spreads right through down your arms and legs, up your head. And it pours out through your pores in all directions, above, below. Front, behind. Right, left. Moves out in all directions. It moves through floors and ceilings and trees and planets. Just washes. So everybody in this room, this light is just going out. If there's someone you want to pray for, like Gary Jensen, or just imagine them being washed by this light. And we think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is no suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is no suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is no suffering. Thank you for your great compassion.